Okay, so we've now created exam one, and I will hand that back to any class. I think probably if you look, your face should be visible on Blackboard. The mean was 69, I think. The median was 69. It's a fairly Gaussian distribution. Certainly, it was fine overall. You know, clearly, if you're down on the curve a lot, something a little bit might be broken with how you're approaching class. Could be time management. Could be you're letting people carry a little bit more chalk or homework. Could be you're not asking the questions you need to ask. I mean, I don't know. So you have to think about that. I have posted the solutions. So you want to look at those very carefully to figure out what went right, what went wrong, think about what that may mean in terms of how to study from here on out. The other exams will be more of the same. So, there was a problem with the problem, which did, I think, account for why everybody was in the room at the end. It turned out that the way that I do these exams is I'll make the test out, then I will copy it, and then I'll do it. I basically make out the solution set there. And in fact, when you look at the solution set, you'll see that it doesn't look exactly like the exam, and there are little notes to myself because I don't bother rewriting all the solutions, but I'll have notes to myself like, oh, I need to add whatever to this problem or fix this figure. And it turned out that I did not succeed in, or didn't fix the figure in the last problem. So there were a couple of things that went wrong. Remember, the last problem was, which many of you probably painfully remember, I guess, there's a point, and then you have an array of speakers, or whatever, wave-created devices, that are separated by a distance d. And I gave you a formula to basically show that for constructive, fully constructive interference, that this formula held true. And in the figure, I had a dot, 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 which made this array go out to infinity. Which, my intent was, since this angle is small, you could use a small angle approximation. And when you did that, it would work. And some of you looked at this thing going out to infinity and assumed you could not make the small angle approximation. Now, when I first was doing this, I wasn't too concerned about that because as you go out to infinity, the amplitude also drops. But the wording of the problem probably meant it needed to be redone for that a little bit. At any rate, I meant to remove the dot, dot, dot or put a limit on that, which I did not do. So sorry about that. The other thing that happened was in the figure, I had things misnumbered. And I needed to renumber those. And someone asked me during the test, don't you mean this zero up in the top should be a one in order to agree with the figure? And I looked at it and I said, oh yeah. But the truth is, once you did that, it screwed up the numbering. So again, even if you made a small angle approximation, we'll assume the amplitude went down to the far, you did not get the right formula. So I understand this. It's the second time in teaching many, many classes that I have managed to get an impossible problem to a class. That's not always a bad thing. There was always a story around Columbia where, you know, there's some number of great mathematical problems that people believe might be soluble and no one has ever solved them. And there was this lore around Columbia that that in one of the theoretical courses the professor assigned one of these problems and one of the students did it. And that student was then my Columbia professor. So anyway, unfortunately, this wasn't one of the great classic problems, and as far as I know, no one actually solved it. We understood that this was broken. I figured it out sort of at the end of the test, but by then it was too late or too much. So we graded accordingly in the sense that there was no expectation that you'd get the right answer. The grading was mushier than that. It was more subjective, and I'm sorry for that, but it was basically the instructions to the grader was to try to sort of ascertain your strategy and to sort of scale based on what you're trying to do with the problem. So that's imperfect, I understand that. The bigger problem, but at some level we can do some subjective judging. It's no worse than somebody reading your papers and giving some subjective judgment on an essay. So although I'm happy with it for physics, that's the way, you know, we can sort of do that. The bigger problem with it that I really can't correct for, and all I can really do is apologize about, is if you decided to spend an inordinate amount of time on that problem and then didn't do some other stuff that you should have done that was easier or not impossible, then you may have gotten hurt. And I can't correct for that, so there's nothing like that for you. So this is, again, one of the reasons why you can drop an exam. Exam grade. I will try very hard not to do this again to you a couple of times. So that said, that's all I can really do about that particular thing. At any rate, you should look at your exams carefully, and you should look, one, for places where you believe the grading may have been unfair, and just remember what we're doing. We are taking what you wrote and we're trying to figure out what you were thinking and then compare that to what you should have been thinking or what we would like you to have thought and getting you some sort of reasonable scale for partial credit. So with that in mind, understand the solutions. So first of all, if you really didn't understand something, go to the solutions and figure it out, because this may not be the last time you see it. But the other is, once you understand the solution, you understand what you did. If you think the judgment relative to partial credit is unfair, by all means, you bring it to my attention. You should check the mathematics, make sure the numbers agree. I think, you know, at least five times a semester for a large class, I have PAs who are putting things in the spreadsheet and they just miss, you know, they'll usually do it in their head and they'll just miss it by 10 points or something, so they have to fix it. If it's in your favor and you don't bring it to my attention, I'm not going to come hunt you down. You don't lose anything if you bring it to me for a regrade, but if I start to get a whole lot of frivolous requests, I'll change that. Okay, so at least look at it and see if you think your request is reasonable. Yes?
Can you post the exact provisions for the grades?
I have the distribution on the web.
Oh, I'm sorry, I just said this.
Well, I just put it out already. Yeah, the full distribution is there, so you can see where you are. I guess since I won't bother handing the exam back till the end of class, someone needs to remind me, but since we're at it, I might as well. I didn't mean to talk so much about the exam, but that's the distribution. And I'm not going to bother putting letter grades on it. Generally, my philosophy is, given the mean is right here, roughly, and admittedly, the bin size is way too small, so you just sort of have to imagine. But clearly, if you're up in here, things are going pretty well, and I wouldn't worry about whatever your study habits are and asking questions and stuff like that. Clearly, you're basically understanding the things that I want you to understand. If you're in here, it can be a mix of things. I mean, basically, it means you're doing fine, you're doing okay. And it may mean that you're a little careless. It may mean some things are sort of slipping through the cracks that maybe shouldn't be. I gave you guys, for example, a four-vector problem comparing masses on it. And I knew that that one would be a struggle for some of you because you're just not really used to that stuff. On the other hand, you could do a four-vector problem or two with invariant mass populations on it. So you might ask yourself, when you look at what you did on the problem, what is it and how I was preparing to make that sort of go past and I didn't pick it up? Was it you weren't asking questions or something like that? So you want to make sure that you start asking questions. If you find you're having trouble starting some of the problems, then you want to think about whether you're working with people on workshops who are blurting out the answers too fast, or you're working with other people who are getting you started, where you don't have somebody getting you started on the exam, whatever. But I'd really, you know, if you're down here, it's also not a disaster, actually. You guys who are in the class, I'm not very concerned. It's a good class. But you might be concerned about what you're missing and why, and if it means you need to put a little more time in the class or ask more questions or something like that, and now's the time to sort of make that change. So I have a regrade policy written for physics 113, so that's quite the class amount. But basically, if you want a regrade, just write what you want on the exam and give it to me, and I'll look at it and make some judgment on it. I may not necessarily always, even if you're in the right and I agree with you, there are a couple of points in here maybe I should give you. Sometimes I won't make a change, but it's in the interest of consistency for the grading, because the PA is graded all across all exams. And if they're too harsh or they're too easy, I lose all ability to actually learn much about evaluation from that problem. But if they are too harsh or too easy, and they're too harsh or too easy to everybody, I can't pick one person and arbitrarily change them. So I have to maintain some consistency. With that in mind. Okay? Any questions, issues, stuff you can, I'll hand them back right then to class. And if you're not here and you want to pick up your exam, you can pick it up in the box outside my office there. So if you have somebody that wants to know where they are, that's where they'll be. Okay? All right, so that's it about the exam. No problems set due next week. I'm really sorry about that. But enjoy your break. And like I say, just sit on the beach and think about how the radiation pressure is getting at you. Explain that to your friends on the beach. I'm sure they'll be very impressed. You can start talking about the standing waves that you can see in the pool. I'm telling you, this course is really great for your love life. All right, so last time we started talking about light, geometric optics basically, and we looked at light in materials, and when light goes into materials, epsilon naught, mu naught, the constants in a vacuum change to epsilon and mu in a substance, and so the velocity is less than the speed of light in a vacuum. And we quantify that by this ratio called the index of refraction. And we've looked at this and I hope satisfied ourselves that the wavelength will actually contract in a substance by this factor n. So if this is the wavelength in the vacuum, the wavelength in the material is the wavelength in the vacuum divided by n. Now, one of the things that's really both horrible and beautiful about optics is that this index of refraction depends on the frequency of the light. And we call this phenomenon dispersion, and we'll talk a lot more about it as we go, and you'll find you talk a whole lot about it as you move up in electromagnetics or electromagnetism, or certainly in optics, because this is one of the things that makes your life miserable, but it's also the basis of many of the wonderful things you can do with light. So we talked about what happens because the velocity changes as you go into a new medium. So imagine that we have a ray of light in a medium characterized by index of refraction 1, and it goes into a medium characterized by index of refraction 2. If N2 is greater than N1, then you'll find this, if we think of it as a ray of light, it gets bent toward the normal to the surface, and we call this the refractive ray, incident ray, reflective ray. Certainly not all of the light necessarily goes into this. This is some of the light may be reflected. That which is reflected is reflected in such a way that the angle of the incidence relative to the normal angle of reflection are the same. The angle of refraction is given by this formula, the Snell's law. And it is basically this law, which we did not derive, but is quite derivable from, actually both of these are quite derivable from Maxwell's equations and Ewell Lewis, but I didn't drag you through that. That gives you the fact that you're bent toward the normal if N2 is greater than N1. You could have the ray of light coming from a higher index of refraction, that is where the light goes slower, into one where the index of refraction is less, and in that case, the light is bent away from the normal. when you're going from a high index of refraction to a low index of refraction, and you're bent away from the normal, then you have something like this orange line. So that would be a reproduction of what we saw in the last slide. You can imagine as you the thetas are always defined with respect to the normal. And if you do what I just did, you just blew the problem on an exam. Fortunately, I only did graded a little in the end of squats, if you guys do it at the end of the term. Anyway, so if you have theta given by this orange theta and you have the beam bent away from the normal, as theta increases, you'll reach the limiting case, which is the pink line, where the ray basically is bent at 90 degrees along the surface. And if you go any larger than that angle, then you'll have total internal deflection. And this is driven by this equation, if you want to look at the mathematics. But you can find that theta sub c is defined to be the angle where the outgoing ray has the sine equal to 1, that is, this angle is 90 degrees. So you can define the critical angle, which is theta sub c, to be N2 over N1. And anything where the ray comes in larger than that is going to be totally internally reflected. So another fun thing that happens with this light, and this is driven by the fact that we have the index of refraction varying with the wavelength. Note that as we go to higher frequency, that is shorter wavelengths, index of refraction is slightly larger than most of these substances, all of these substances, than it is when you're in the red, quote-unquote, longer wavelength, the lower frequency. So that means that if you have light being refracted as it goes into a medium, these different wavelengths, these different frequencies, will be refracted through different angles. And so this is the basis behind prisms and the such. So you can imagine either for the upper edges of a lens or the upper edges of a prism, you have something of this happening where you have light coming in, it is bent because you're going from air into glass. You have small n, high n, and you're bent toward the normal. And then this ray comes in and it hits this interface, and you're going from high n to low n, and it's bent away from the normal. So in the case of a lens with surfaces with this orientation, light coming in here is bent this direction. Light coming this way gets bent that way, and the light will convert. In the case of the prism, you have a very similar thing happening. But one of the things I want to point out on this slide is because the dispersion, that is, because the index of refraction is greater for the blue light than it is for the red light, the blue light gets bent a little bit more than the red light. And this is why if you take white light, which is a mix of frequencies, and you look at what comes out of the prism, you'll have a mixture of colors. But it's not just a random mixture, right? You're splitting the frequencies. So this is the basis of lots of great devices. Prisms aren't used that often anymore. Usually people use gratings, and we'll get the gratings when we do diffraction. But you can also find that how the interference and diffraction occurs also will depend on wavelength, and it's a very nice way of separating out different frequencies of light and analyzing signals that way. So we will spend a while talking about thin lenses today, and converging lens, as I say, because of the orientation of these surfaces, will take rays of light from this side and bend them that way, rays of light from this side and bend them that way, they will converge. If you take the lens and you make it thinner in the middle, then the same phenomenon happens, except now the light will be bent away. Right? And it's called diverging because of that. These are also known as convex lenses. These are known as concave lenses. And if you can't keep that straight, just remember, you can live in a little cave here and here because it's like that. That's how you remember. Okay? Concave. And the other is the convex. One of the things that dispersion does for you in optics is it makes life sort of hard in some ways. If you can imagine using an optical element and you're trying to dim light to create an image on the other side, if you have something that has many different frequencies in it, you'd like to be able to bend them all the same way so that they converge at the same point. There are all sorts of aberrations that can happen in lenses where they're not quite perfect, and we'll ignore most of that in all of our calculations. But an example would be chromatic dispersion, where because the blue light is bent more than the red light, if you have a fairly dispersive lens, then you will actually have image planes, that is, the points where these rays converge, that differ. And that means you'll have a hard time making a clean image because the where is it? What color light do you want to focus? So if you go into optics, this will also be part of the fun you're going to have, is to figure out how to make combinations of lenses that fix this problem, that take out the aberrations and give you a much more perfect image. It also leads to problems in optical fibers. So in optical fibers, one way to picture them is you can either have a graded index of refraction or you can have a sharp change. But maybe for simplicity, let's think of it as a sharp change, so that there's an angle at which the incoming light at the end of the optical fiber is now going to come in at an angle greater than the critical angle. And so you'll have total internal reflection at each of these interfaces, basically, unless you bend the fiber so much where you might begin to have light actually not being so internally reflected. So that's the basic idea of a simple version of an optical fiber. And if you wanted to send a pulse of light, which is made up of different frequencies of light, then the critical angle is going to be different for those, and the speed of the different frequencies will be different. And so what you'll find is that you'll actually get the pulse to change in shape. It'll actually lengthen, and you'll get a pulse problem because you have chromatic dispersion in fiber. And one of the gains in telecommunications is to use optical fibers and types of pulses where you don't have that kind of stuff in so much as you can avoid it. So that if you have a signal that's pulses separated by non-pulses, you have zeros and ones of some sort that you can actually separate them out. And of course, sometimes you also want the signals carried by different frequencies, so maintaining the structure of what you put in turns out to be very important, and there's a lot of gains in trying to figure that out. There's a question
there. What causes the signal to fade away over long distance?
That's basically just absorption. When you send something through a material, you will have some types of scattering. Yeah. And then, so there's a lot of gains in optical fiber business of you don't really have the electromagnetic wave going out into a sphere, so you don't have that intensity drop the way that you do with light from the sun or light from a candle. But you do have scattering and different processes happening in the fiber, which can absorb or scatter a little bit of the light. And so you have a small loss like that. And boy, at one point I was actually doing research on effects of the gravitational redshift on... If you send light in a fiber that has dispersion, That means if you have if the fiber goes up and you have a gravitational redshift on the light, it's because of it's changing the frequency of the light, and the speed of the light will change, you know, where you are. And so I was working with trying to come up with devices that we might be able to use where we could basically use optical interferometric effects for beams of light sort of counterpropagating to make a high precision measurement of general relativity. So at one point I knew a lot about optical fibers and could tell you exactly what that distance is for your typical optical fiber, but it's something on the order of what seemed to remember 10 or 100 kilometers or something. But at that point you have to put in a repeater, so you basically get the signal, you then re-emit it, but that adds noise into the system because that's not a perfect thing. You have photon counting noise and things like that. So that's imperfect. And so there are certain, well, if you get into an optical fiber, of course, you'll find there's lots of neat devices that they use to try to get around this problem. But effectively now, you can actually store a signal, a light signal, and you can, say, put it in a loop and let it basically go forever and then pull it out. And you still have coherence, but you have to use the right kind of pulses and the right kind of amplifiers. And it's an interesting field. Yeah. That would be the Doppler shift of light for relativity. Doppler shift is due to speed. In general relativity, the light frequency changes as it goes into different gravitational potentials as well. I think I mentioned that when we were doing hand waving on general relativity, but I didn't make a big deal of it. So if I have a source of light that surfaces the Earth, and I measure the frequency of the emitted light up here, I will get something where the frequency has been redshifted a little bit. So you have to correct for this for GPS. And if you're looking at spectra from things like the sun and stuff like that, you have to understand that if you see things redshift a little bit, not just because the sun is moving away from us, it may also have this gravitational effect. Yeah, that stuff. Okay. So, we'll look you up a little bit. Well, suppose that we have four perfectly linearly polarizing plates. And we stack them up. We have unpolarized light coming in the bottom, and then each plate is rotated at 30 degrees. What's the intensity of the light that comes out at the top? You are most welcome to use a pencil and paper and a calculator if you want. those of you who have any intent to think about this, how many of you still want to know? In your mind which one you think it is, then close your eyes. I'm sorry, fix in your mind which number, not just whether 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. That's what I'm going to ask you. I want you to raise your hand when I get to the number of the answer you believe it is. So close your eyes so that you're not biased by anything except the rustle of close one up. All right. All of those who think it is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay. Let's see. We had almost an even distribution of hands for these three. Slightly fewer here. Slightly fewer here, and none here, or maybe one here. No, I think it was none there. There were a couple here, actually, so it's more than slightly. So I think only a couple here. Okay? We did have about an even distribution here. So let's look at it. Oops, wrong one. Come back to that one. So we have, in this case, we have light coming in. It hits the first polarizer. It is unpolarized light, so the intensity drops by a factor of 2. I guess that one would, by definition, be like that. Okay. So if this is I0, then the intensity that passes through the first polarizer is going to be 1/2 I0. You're wiping out half the amplitude. Then the intensity drops by a factor of cosine squared at the angle. So just to remind you of how that happens, if I have an electric field with a certain amplitude here, and I have a polarizer that only allows a certain angle through, this angle, say, is 30 degrees, then the component of the electric field that gets through is going to be the original times the cosine of 30, and then intensity goes as amplitude squared. So that's what brings in the... Yep? It is. This is just how I draw it to maximize confusion. Sorry. Yeah, I'm not taking the polarizer plate and doing this. Oh, no. Okay, so I want to thank you for asking that, because my guess is there's 7 other people in the room who are sitting there going, what? This guy's on drugs. No. This is I don't know how to draw that rotation in the plane. So what I do is I draw it this way. And then I don't say anything about it because, I mean, I don't know how else to get that mean to sort of spread down. And it hurts me when the mean crawls up above 70. So, okay. So that means that here... got to have orange for this. So here, the intensity change going from here to here is the incoming intensity times cosine 30 squared. So I have 1/2 I0 times the cosine square of 30, and then Here, I get the incoming intensity times the cosine square of 30. So I have 1/2 I0 times the cosine to the fourth of 30. And then that which eventually comes out to your I is 1/2 I0 times the cosine 630. Okay? And when I calculated that, I got 21%. If you said 42, maybe you forgot that I, that one factor of a half.
How did you get that?
I may have gotten it wrong. I don't know. I used my calculator.
What did you use for I-bomb?
It's the relative difference.
Right, so
that just cancels out. Yeah. So it's just whatever this factor 1/2 times the cosine of 30 to the 6th power. You're in radians. Boy, that sucks. Yeah. Yeah. I've got to tell you. There are two things you got to check before you go into an electromagnetic or optical exam. Right? It's like, this is my right hand, and you just have to know I can look at it, and the other is, and I am right-handed. Okay, there was a hand in my mouth. And it's a right hand, too. Yeah?
Can I ask you the question?
You can ask me the question.
Can I see the question?
You can see the question. I guess. That wording gives you the factor two. I don't know if that was what's bothering you. Okay. Since we had so much fun with that one, let's do this one. What gives diamonds their sparkle? Because you can make something with the exact same shape with glass, for example. But you won't impress your girl if you give her a glass.
Just because the height index, more angles are considered for the center.
Okay. That makes sense to anybody?
Yes.
How so? Put it in terms of what we're doing. Yeah?
So that the angle that the light's going to come and hit the glass or the diamond, more angles that are critical.
They're going to be more, there is a larger angular region.
Yeah.
Always have to stop and think about it. The critical angle for diamonds is much larger. So that means there's a larger fraction of the light that's coming in at an angle smaller than critical angle is actually in, goes through the interface. So light hitting the bottom will go through. So the critical angle, if you calculate it for diamonds, is larger Jeez, this is not my day. That's theta sub c. Alright, so hopefully I actually did the calculation right. This angle is smaller for diamond. Okay, so that means the cone of the light that hits the surface that continues through, it has to be within that cone, theta 60, right? Any light that's coming at a larger angle, out here for example, is totally internally reflected. And because this angle is smaller because of the large index of refraction here in U1, you're going to have much less light that actually will make it through the bottom and diamond. Most of it gets reflected back. And maybe multiple reflections. And so that's what, in the end, makes it sparkle. It's just that you see more light coming back out at All right, that would be a very typical kind of conceptual question from the exam. In fact, I'm pretty sure I've thrown that one on an exam before. Physics 1 for 14ers, we're very happy about that, I think. Okay. So, I find that if I do thin lenses and mirrors by hand, the diagrams are messy and it takes forever and it's hard to do to make it work. So I have some slides that have evolved where I want to talk about some aspects of thin lenses and the such. So, with your forgiveness, I'm going to show them to you. And I freely have stolen stuff from different sources because they have good graphics. All right, so we talked about a little bit. If the lens is thicker in the middle, we call it convex. Okay, and if it's thinner in the middle, you can have a little cave within it and you know it's concave. But these are converging lenses because you're thicker in the middle. And whenever you have a converging lens, the way to think about it is, the light converges. But we want to get quantitative with that, and it's always good to be able to sort of think your way through graphically what's going on with the lenses to see if your analytical calculations make any sense. So the trick often is to think of light as coming from a single point on an object, which is some distance from the center of the lens. We're considering in this class only thin lenses, so we don't really need to worry about the fact that there's a finite thickness to this lens. You can imagine that it's infinite like that. But sorry, I wanted to. Oh. Not good. Okay. Hello. Give me a second, sorry. That's what I want. So when we have a thin lens, we characterize it by something which is called the focal length. And what we mean by that is if we have rays of light that are coming parallel to one another, and what we usually mean by that is we say that the source is at infinity. So if you see a problem phrase, sources at infinity, or it says, you have a planar wave coming in or whatever, it basically means if you think of the light as being formed, just little laser beams, that they're all coming in exactly parallel to one another. And what the focal length tells you is if you have rays coming in from infinity, when they hit the lens in the absence of aberrations of different sorts, they will all go through the point, which we call the focal point. So this is the focal length, F. And I know that you're all very familiar with this because this is how you burn in. Right? You move the lens until you get the focal point of all the light collected by the lens that goes to the point and burns the ant. If you haven't burned ants before with a lens, you're missing out. Gotta go do it. Makes you feel very powerful. Sorry. Okay. If we have a diverging lens, you can think of it as the same sort of thing. For a diverging lens, it differs from the converging lens because it's thinner in the middle, so I draw it somehow like that. And now you say, aha, but I know that the light rays are diverging away so they don't hit one another, and that is true. In this case, the light goes and it is bent away. And the way that you think of the focal point for a diverging lens is you extrapolate these rays back, and they meet at a point, the extrapolated rays back will meet at a point which you call the focal point, and this would be the focal length for the diverging lens. And the conventions of the formulas will use the converging lens, the f is getting a positive number, the diverging lens is getting a negative number. And it actually works. Here's one where we're thicker in the middle, and I have rays of beam, you know, laser coming out straight lines, and you can see that it's converging, and you can see that we have some pretty serious aberrations, but don't let that bother you. If I take one where I'm thinner in the middle, put it in, then you can see the rays diverge, and to find the focal length, you would sort of think of them as coming back. Okay. So the more powerful the lens, the more the things diverge or converge, and the shorter is the focal length. And generally, you can think of that as sort of the degree to which you're thick to thin. If you have, you know, more of a curvature, then it'll be a more powerful lens. And of course, if you have a lot of curvature, you can no longer really treat it as a thin lens, but that we're not worrying about. That you worry about when you get into your internship this summer or whatever in the real world. Here's an example of something where I have the ray of light coming in, and note that if I have the angle of incident for the ray of light hitting this surface to be fairly small, remember it's the angle of perspective of the normal, then the ray of light comes through. So, let's see if I can just do one. Hit these reflecting rays can cause problems too. So now you can see that the light is coming in and hits at each of these surfaces, it gets bent. And you see that it goes all the way through. Now I'm going to increase the angle of incidence for this internal ray on this external surface. Well, probably, but you can see that what happens when I increase that angle enough, I have the internal reflection. So I have total internal reflection of that. Well, if we use a mirror, you can see that if you think about it, the normal to the surface is like this, so you can basically see the angle of refraction is equal to the angle of reflection is equal to the angle of incidence. And since I have this out here, I don't think we're going to get to it today, but we may talk about spherical mirrors at some point because it's very similar to what happens with thin lenses. I'll probably cut some corners on because it's so similar. But you have different things, like the spherical mirror, if it's curved this way, you'll get the light rays that are reflected diverging. And if it is curved in, you get the light rays conversing. Okay? And so we'll talk a bit about spherical mirrors, but we're going to do thin lenses first. Okay? So what I want to do is get quantitative with this. And before you get quantitative, it's good to have a sense of what's going on. And there are sort of rules of thumb that help when you're trying to sketch these things out. So let us suppose we have an object out at distance O, object distance, and it has a certain height. A way to sort of think your way through what's going on is to imagine you have three rays of light that are coming from this point. Obviously, you have lots of rays of light that are coming from that point, but let's just follow three. And the reason I want to follow these particular three is because as they go through the lens, there's a very particular algorithm as to where they're supposed to go. So this ray comes straight in from infinity, which means it is parallel to this optical axis of the lens. Okay, so you can think of it as coming from an object that's so far away that the light is coming straight in. Because of that, the way we've defined the focal point, we know that it's bent from the lens and goes through this focal point on the other side. Then we have a ray that comes straight through the center of the lens. And a way to think of what happens at the center of the lens is that these surfaces, you can imagine them being parallel so that that ray isn't bent at all. So that goes straight through. And then a ray that comes through the focal point basically is this backwards. If it comes through the focal point, it gets bent and goes straight. And if you look, these rays are emitted by a point here and they come back together at a point over there. And so that means the tip of this arrow gets imaged there. So you can, that image then, if I put a piece of paper, that would be where I would get a clean image of the light, because although we use just this point, the same is true for every other point along that object. It's upside down, we call that inverted. And so this is an image distance that may be different from the optical distance, but you can think your way through it by looking at what happens to those three particular rays. So for concave lenses, the ones that are thinner in the middle, as I mentioned, we think of the focal point by looking at how the rays diverge and then projecting them back, and that would be the focal length of the lens. And again, you use three rays if you want to sort of pictorially figure out what you think is going on. And so the ray from infinity, if this is your real object, the ray from infinity gets bent in such a way that the ray that is extrapolated backwards goes straight through the focal point. The ray that goes straight through the lens to the focal point on the other side is such that when it gets diverged, in a sense, it goes straight out of infinity. So it's a ray that would go through the focal point on the other side, but it doesn't, because it's bent. And so it's bent so that it goes straight. So this one and that one, again, are sort of the inverse halves of one another. And then the one that goes straight through the lens and passes through where the lens meets the optical axis is unimpeded and doesn't get bent, it goes straight. So you have these three rays, and they quite truly are diverging. Okay, so what do you really mean when you talk about an image? You sort of have to imagine that what your eye sees would be effectively these three rays. And these three rays would look to your eye as if they came from an object that was upright and this size and that distance away, which is where the extrapolated rays be. Okay? So sometimes it's a little hard to visualize, because especially when you have these images, which in a sense aren't real. I mean, because I can't put a piece of paper here and actually create an image. But it is the image that you would perceive if you have your eye on the other side. And these problems, that we're going to quantitatively begin to look at these objects and image distances, and the thing to remember is I have multiple elements. The image formed from the first element becomes the object for the second element, because the second element sees the rays of light as if they are coming from that image. And the minute you make that step, it's as if that other lens doesn't exist, the first lens. So we'll do that, but that's the
sort of the touchiest part of these types of problems.
Lenses have different powers, and generally we put the power in diopters, where the focal length is in meters, and it's positive for converging, negative for
diverging. Oops. Okay.
So to get, the other thing is, you've already seen that the image may vary in orientation, may vary in size, and that will depend on the orientation of these things and the power of the lens. We define the magnification to be the ratio of this height to that height. So it can be smaller or it can be bigger than the original, so is it magnified or not? And if you look at the geometry of this, you can see that there's a similarity between this height and this distance and that distance. So this minus sign is thrown in to, basically that has to do with conventions that we'll talk about a moment ago, but the way that you want to have it is that your magnification is negative if you have something inverted. We relate, for thin lenses only, we relate the object and image distances and the focal length by this simple equation known as the lens equation, which I could derive for you, but I didn't think to do it. I'm sorry. So I'm not going to do it on the fly. At any rate, we have an object distance, we have an image distance, and we have a focal length, and those things are related. And so that piece of it is easy. The hard part is conventions. You have to make sure that you have the signs of these things correct, because in principle, if I have one lens, it's sort of obvious, I think, that the object distance, the object would always be on this side, and the object distance would be positive if that's the case. Generally, for a converging lens, for example, the image is on the other side, so I would call that a positive image distance, and the focal length would be positive for a converging lens. So that sort of makes sense. It's a little touchier for a diverging lens, because as we've seen for conventional cases, the object out here, you'll actually get an image on the other side. So you might flip the convention. The other problem is, if I have multiple lenses in the system, I can have an object which is actually on the other side of the lens. So you have to have a convention in place in order to keep all this stuff straight. And so Gene Coley gives you a convention, which is the convention that I will use in the class. And I'm trying to remember, I may be thinking about Kirchhoff's law convention. There is a convention that we have in Gene Coley, which is actually different from the convention that's taught in, I guess it's electrical engineering. But for those of you in optics, I hope this is sort of the same convention you use. No, it's not. Okay. So for these problems, then, I don't know. I don't want to force you into this convention necessarily. But these conventions are such that whatever you do, you better be consistent about it throughout the problem. And one of the issues that I have is, if you don't use this convention, the TAs are going to have a little bit harder time debugging what you were getting or not getting. Which means, if you're not going to use this convention, I'm going to ask that, maybe I'll try to remember when it comes. We need to know it from the grading exam. Okay? And actually, if one of you who has, if your standard optics class uses a different convention that you want to use or whatever, email me what it is, so at least we know. Okay? But this is the convention being told. So, focal length positive for converging lens, negative for diverging lens. The object distance is positive if it's on the side of the lens where the light is coming from. So in the sense that I have a converging lens with an object over here, that light is coming from a real object and it then converges and gives me a real image on the other side. So the image distance is positive if it's on the other side of the lens. If it's on the same side of the lens that the object's on, so you have a virtual image, then it's going to be negative in this particular convention. It's positive for real images, it's negative for virtual images, I guess is another way of saying it. And then the height of the image is positive if the image is upright, negative if the image is inverted. Again, I think whatever convention you use, just be consistent as you're doing the problems. I want to talk a little bit about some fun with thin lenses and sort of eyes and other optical instruments and things. So, this is your eye, minus the labels, unless you're into tattoos. But, so your eye is an amazing thing. This lens, you have muscles that can actually change its shape and adjust its focal length on the fly. And you have this surface, so you have a lot of curvature right here, and this does the residual correction to that. And it gives you an image that's formed on the back of the eye where you have nerves that are sensitive to the different frequencies of light. You can tell you things. So this is very cool. Now, if you are nearsighted, what it means is that your eye is not able to make this, or has this a little bit too strong, so that you focus the light a little bit before the back of the eye. Or I say this is too strong, it means your eye shape is such that this is out a little bit further than it ought to be. So the way to fix that is to put contact lenses or glasses in your eye where you're thinner in the middle than in the outside, so you cause the rays to diverge a little bit to correct for it so that they show right at the back of the eye. If you're farsighted, it looks like this. You have to converge a little bit, so you have the Coke bottle lenses. The problem with these lenses is they get very thick on the outside, but if you have your far side, if you find you're thicker on the inside. So you can look at your glasses and figure out. Of course, you can also take your glasses off and decide whether you're not able to see it or you're seeing it far away. So I used to be very nearsighted. And for me, I had LASIK a few years ago, and I have a video of the surgery. It's absolutely cool. Have you ever seen that? I should try to bring it in. Well, so the technology in eye correction changes pretty fast, and there's some really amazing work going on with Institute of Optics. I'm ditzing on who it is that's doing it right now, where they're taking lasers and they are sending them in with certain focal points, and they're literally taking patterns. So in the middle, okay, they're not using eyes yet, or maybe they're starting to use animal eyes. I don't know, but they were using materials that were similar to eyes. Some of you may have worked in the lab. But they basically can take the laser, and in the middle of the substance, they can heat it so it changes the index of refraction. So they can literally, instead of adjusting the shape of the eye, they will just change the index of refraction with a certain pattern. So that may be where it's going, because that's really cool. It's non-invasive. In my case, it's a little bit grosser. And I should try to see if I can digitize the video and bring it in for you. I'm sure it's on the web. You can find one. But it was totally cool. So Scott McRae, he's the guy whose ads you'll see all over the place. He's the surgeon that does at URMC. And I went to him in part because, well, okay, let me explain what it is he does. So at the time, and it may have changed a little bit now, they literally would take a device that they would sort of pressure suck onto your eye. Your eyelids are up, okay, you're totally awake. There's a little bit of pain deadening on your eye. But they take a device that literally latches onto your eyeball, and it slides a razor blade right through here across your cornea and cuts it, but it leaves a flap. So then, and this is really good in the video, you can take it and you can literally lift this top part of the cornea up and flip it over. And you have then bared sort of the middle of the cornea right there. Then you take a UV laser that shoots and burns away, reshaping the anterior piece of the cornea. Then you sort of wipe that clear and you flip this thing back over. And you don't stitch it. It turns out that if you don't rub your eyes too hard the first month or something, it'll actually reseal. And what you've done is you've basically taken that surface that you've removed mass with a certain shape underneath it, and that allows, that literally reshapes the surface of this, and that changes the optics as it goes through. And that's how it does it. Not everybody has a cornea that's thick enough, so not necessarily everybody's a candidate for this particular surgery. It works very well. I went to this particular guy because he was working with the guy who's now dean of, not Clark, but the other dean of graduate research here in the institute, in the Eye Institute, Plum Eye Institute. And they had developed a laser, a technique to be able to look through the back of this so that they could not just correct the large order nearsighted versus farsighted, but to literally shape it for smaller order imperfections. So for astigmatism, for example, so the first order is simply this. Are you basically focusing in the right place? But second order, it might be something like, okay, are you a little fuzzy over here relative to here? And then you might have higher order things, so you might look at quadrants and you might look at 16th. So there are different ways to look at it. And so the more perfect the image, then the more perfect you have it in all those different modes. But it means you're, just like Fourier analysis, you're now correcting it on smaller and smaller distance scales. So they have a laser which has smaller spot size. So in principle, they could literally correct your vision to higher and higher order and give you vision that is better than normal. And in fact, I have that. In one of my eyes, I was seeing, you know, 20/20 would be normal. I was seeing 20/10, which means I could see things at 20 feet that a person with normal eyesight could really only see at 20 feet. 10 feet, sorry, not about it. I could see things at 20 feet that other people could see it. And my other eye was like 20/15, so it was sort of, I mean, I don't know if it's a lot of portfolio. But if you ever do such a thing, I have one really strong piece of advice for you. Well, there are two things. One is the warning. Hopefully this changed a little bit. The thing I was not prepared for, it actually didn't hurt, okay, and you'd think it really would. It was really gross in that sense, but it didn't really hurt that much. But they flipped the cornea back, and, during the thing, what they don't prepare you for is when they're zapping your eye, you smell it burning. And that is really disturbing. So that one, nobody tells you that before surgery. The other thing that you just have to remember if you ever do this, and first of all, you can't do it, you don't want to ever do it until you are old enough. As you get older, what happens is whether you're farsighted or nearsighted, basically will stabilize up to the point that your eyes always naturally change in this way, I guess, or the lens changes. Your ability to change the shape of the lens changes so that you find you're unable to focus as things get closer. So basically, when you pass 40, by the time you're 45, everyone you know has reading glasses. If there's like a 5-year period in there where your lens, you can no longer change so much. So there's nothing you can do about that, really. I mean, you could correct the vision then, but it's going to continue to get worse. You're going to need stronger and stronger reading glasses with time anyway. But when you're young, the eye shape is changing. It's not just the limbs. And so you have to wait until you're old enough that the eye shape stops changing, and that's when you have the surgery. So that's often, you know, late 20s, mid-30s, somewhere in there, and that's when you can do it. So by then, it'd probably be a totally new world. But if you were to do this type of thing, find out about what the surgery is and whether there's residual swelling that happens later. When you have this, you do get some swelling. So every night you're sort of tired, your eye hurts a little bit, and it swells. The cool thing about that is when it swells, it will take point sources of light and sort of give them fuzzy halos. So if you do this like mid-December, it's like the most beautiful Christmas we've ever had. So for me, it was pure serendipity. I did it in mid-December, and it was an amazing Christmas. I mean, totally, people would completely pay lots of money for a drug that does that. Which is a drug idea for you if you want to go into drug production instead. But it was very cool. So maybe I'll bring you to surgery. So you can have all sorts of aberrations. It's what's called spherical aberration, where your focal length is really different for different positions along the lens. So you basically would, if you have a good image for things coming through the middle, you might not. So here you would have a picture where you might have the middle in focus and the outer edge is sort of going out of focus. Chromatic aberration happens because you have dispersion and you have a different focal length for the red and the blue. If you're designing real optical instruments, then you can use multiple combinations of lenses to take these kinds of aberrations out, or you can use graded indices of refraction and things like that. We've already seen the electromagnetic spectrum and the fact that our eye is only sampling a measly little tiny piece of it. One of the things that's sort of interesting is if you take this spectrum and convolute it with the sensitivity for your average human eye, here's the sensitivity curve that we have over the spectrum that we're able to see at all. And what you see is that your sensitivity peaks very highly in the green. And you may have noticed that light coming from different types of emitters really looks quite different. And the reason for this is that the spectrum emitted by those things is different. So how it strikes you is quite different. So this would be a spectrum of basic daylight. You have large sensitivity right where daylight is peaking. Duh. Right? Evolution at work. That's totally cool. And then we go and we make incandescent lamps, and it has a spectrum that falls off this way. Why? Because you're heating it up, right? So you will, this light, we haven't said the P word, but it's sort of more energy per photon, so you have to heat it up hotter to make it glow blue as opposed to red. So you're going to have this fall off. But that will give you a very distinct color for an incandescent light, which sort of looks, we call it warm. It will look sort of reddish on the scale of things. If you have a fluorescent lamp, it tends to look a bit bluer because the spectrum is shifted over a bit. And if you go and you go buy fluorescent lamps, you'll literally find cold ones and warm ones and stuff. And what they're doing is they're shifting this spectrum a bit. So, boy, I had something cool I was going to say. I totally forgot what it was. Any questions? Are you kidding me? Oh, man.
Okay. Crap.
Sorry.
Okay. We're coming back to this then after break. Have a fun break. I thought I had like 15 or 20 minutes. More minutes. Sorry.
We have to do exams. Sorry, let me hand this back.
I think I pretty much told you what I was going to tell you
about them. So you need to look at them and see what you think. If you have Q through a Z, I'm putting them here. M through P is going here. I through L here. E through H here. And A through D is on the left column.
I'll put up the curve